the Meat Eater Podcast coming at you shirtless, severely bug-bitten, and in my case, underwearless.
We hunt the Meat Eater Podcast.
You can't predict anything.
All right, Steve, I want you to do two things, but you got to do it in the order, in this order. Explain, like, what is a nutria and where are they from and all that. And then explain who you are and where you're from and all that.
All right, yeah, sure. A nutria is a big semi-aquatic rodent that's native to South America. At one time, it was highly prized for its fur, and it was introduced throughout the world in fur farms and things like that to create a economic resource for rural folks. And similar to mink ranches and that sort of thing. It's intermediate in size between a muskrat and a beaver, for those familiar with our North American semi-aquatic.
Like how many pounds?
The average is probably between 15 and 17 pounds for an adult male.
Big.
Yeah, well, they're big, yeah. And, you know, I guess if I were to equate
compare it to something?
Probably a
raccoon.
Yeah, raccoon. Bigger than a woodchuck. Similar in size to a raccoon. I think the biggest female that we caught was about 21 pounds. And, you know, when they're gravid and full of little ones, they can tip the scales at higher than the males do. So,
what's the word you just used?
Gravid? Pregnant?
Gravid?
Am I getting all academic here?
No, I'm going to start throwing that word around all over the place. Pregnant is gravid? Say my God, wife.
I think
my
so. Wife's I yeah. Get out my thesaurus app.
Yanni will check it. Yanni will fact check you on that.
So they're really kind of an interesting animal too, though. A lot of people don't know this, but they get fascinated when they hear that the nipples on a female nutria are located along their back, so the young can actually suckle when they're swimming in the water.
Didn't know that either.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
I have like I've never laid eyes on a nutria.
You know, I hadn't either before I took this job that I took to try to help eliminate them from the Chesapeake Bay. But they're a pretty amazing animal, very adaptable. They're herbivores, as most rodents are. They dig up the roots and tubers, the underground parts of plants in the wetland ecosystems here. And in doing so, they expose it to tremendous erosion with the tidal influx of water and whatnot. So,
and that's how muskrat feeds too, right,
yeah.
Steve?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, muskrats will eat, you know, one of the things that they're most known for is they'll eat cattail roots and parts of cattails, but they'll eat clams rarely, but mostly they eat aquatic vegetation and they excavate it.
The excavating from banks is what causes folks to get mad at them.
What gets muskrats in trouble with folks is their denning activities, more than their feeding activities, is they dig bank dens and make an underwater entrance, and then they'll burrow up into a bank and then make a big hollow in the bank, and then, you know, some dude will be like mowing his lawn and all of a sudden falls into a muskrat bank den. That's what gets muskrats in trouble.
I used to get free haircuts from some ladies that had a muskrat problem in their pond at their little hair cuttery up in Plattsburgh, New York.
So you trap muskrats for haircuts?
Yeah, I've trapped muskrats. I was the muskrat man to them, and I got my hair cut for free. So
good.
It's a barter economy.
So we'll get into this whole trapping thing. So, but now that you broached the subject, we're going to have to explore the fact that you were trapping before you became a government trapper.
Yes, I was.
I guess now's the time when you can tell us about who you are.
Then
we'll get
sure.
back into nutrias. I just wanted a little teaser about those back nipples.
Oh, yes. So I'm Steve Kendrott. I'm a wildlife biologist. I work for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services Program. It's a small agency, about 2,000 people nationwide. It's within the Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service in the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And our primary mission is to provide federal leadership in the resolving human-wildlife conflicts. And our primary mission areas are to protect agriculture, human health and safety, property, and increasingly natural resources, which is how we're entwined with this whole nutria eradication project to try to save the Chesapeake Bay marshlands. So I've been with that agency for about 18 years now. I started out as a wildlife biologist at an airport, actually a military base in Virginia. I also worked at two of the Washington, D.C. airports. But in 2002, I took this job in Cambridge, Maryland.
Hold on, question. What's an airport need a biologist for?
Well, so birds and planes both occupy the same airspace, and oftentimes to great detriment to both the birds and the planes. So we actually have a very robust program throughout the country. Most of our major airports, we've got wildlife biologists stationed there working to provide guidance to the airport about how to minimize wildlife habitat and attractants on the airfield to keep them away from the runways and taxiways. Deer, coyotes, other mammals are also problems that get on the runways and get hit by planes during takeoff and landing and so on and so forth. So it's a pretty big human health and safety component of our program.
Yep. Yeah, because that could be like a lot of deaths all at once.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, yeah, the dude that put the plane down in the Hudson hit a goose.
Yep, several geese.
Several geese.
Yep, Miracle on the Hudson was the result of a bird strike with Canada geese. There was also a tragic Air Force accident back in, gosh, I don't even remember when that was now. Well, it's been so long since I've worked on the airport stuff, but in Elmendorf Air Force Base. A plane went down from that and killed quite a few service folk. So
went down from a goose or bird collision. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's, not to scare the flying public. I know you guys will be on a plane soon. Not a lot to worry about. It's a low risk, but a high consequence kind of thing. So it's something the airports take very seriously. The FAA takes very seriously. And as a result, we've got a pretty robust program nationwide.
So most of those biologists are employed by your agency then?
Yeah, and so our agency is kind of unique in that it doesn't get a huge slug of federal appropriations or tax dollars to do the work we do. We work through cooperative agreements with other federal agencies, municipalities, airports, that sort of thing, private individuals. So it's very much a cost-sharing type program where the recipients of the services that we provide are paying for at least some portion, if not all, of the service that we provide. So we're not a regulatory agency like some of the other federal agencies, the Fish and Wildlife Service, that enforce regulations about endangered species and all that kind of thing. We're very much problem-solving service orientation. And so, yeah, it's been a really interesting agency to work for. And this project in the Chesapeake Bay with the nutria is funded by the Fish and Wildlife Service, the United States Fish and Wildlife Service, which is in the Department of Interior. They're the folks that oversee the National Wildlife Refuge System.
So to jump into the nutria, like just to lay the groundwork on the nutria situation in Chesapeake Bay, which is a pretty fascinating story. But how did it begin? Like, when did they come in, and why did they come in?
So they were brought.
And
in,
as a side note, can they live? Are they? Can they adapt to northern climates, or they like to have? Or do they need warmer weather and not severe winters?
They are limited in their northern distribution by winter weather. However, here in Maryland is about the northernmost distribution on the East Coast. Okay. But nutria also, they've been established in 17 or 18 different states in the U.S. Introduced in a number of more, but they haven't become established. A lot of people don't know that your home city of Seattle and Portland are home to the nutria as well.
Really? Where?
All over in the coastal wetlands and a lot of the parks in Portland, Oregon. People feed carrots and stuff like that. It's kind of crazy. So you don't have to go far to
see nutria. I thought the reason I'd never seen one is I'd always lived in the northern tier states.
Yeah. No. Huh. They're limited to the coastal distribution because of the temperate climate there.
Yep. But
So where was I?
How and why did they come into the Chesapeake Bay? Like who put them there and for what reason?
So the nutria were brought to the Chesapeake region in 1943 or thereabouts. There was two entities that had nutria brought in. The Blackwater actually had the refuge itself had a fur bearer research station at one time. And they housed nutria, and they were doing nutria research as well as muskrat and that sort of thing. But there were also some private entrepreneurs that were bringing nutria in to farm them. And for some reason, that never really took off economically. And eventually, the farms either went out of business and they released their animals, or the conditions just became dilapidated and they escaped and whatnot.
Did that coincide with the drop in fur prices overall?
No, it was quite a bit, I think, before the drop in fur prices. And so nutria didn't really become an ecological impact in the Chesapeake Bay region until probably the late 1960s, 1970s. And that's pretty typical for a lot of introduced invasive species, is that they'll exist at fairly low levels for an extended period of time and then begin to grow exponentially. And once they hit that sort of critical mass in numbers, then that population can just like explode and go through the roof. And so that's what happened throughout the 1970s and 80s. And they estimated at one point that Blackwater was probably home to over 50,000 nutria. And that corresponded with a very significant decline in emergent marshlands at Chesapeake, at the Chesapeake Marshlands National Wildlife Complex or Refuge Complex, but that Blackwater unit at one point was about 13,000 or so acres of wetlands, and they lost about 5,000 acres of that over the course of, well, between 1938 and 1999 or so.
Almost half.
Yeah, it was very significant. You look at the aerial photographs of the core of the heart of Blackwater Refuge, and you can see that it's just been converted almost entirely to open water. So, huge ecological impact.
And you said emergent marshes?
Yeah, emergent marshes are those wetlands where the plants actually emerge out of the water. So you look out and you see vegetation, basically.
Oh.
As opposed to like a lily pad type environment or that sort of thing. So the typical marshes that we have here in the coastal regions of the Chesapeake Bay are characterized by three-square bulrush, cattails in some of the more fresher headwaters of this sort of drainage system. And the closer you get to the bay and higher salinities, you'll get more needle rush, salt hay, those different types of plant communities. So the one that's really critical, and probably from a wildlife perspective, one of the most valuable habitat types is the three-square marsh. It produces a lot of seeds that are fed on by migrating birds and that sort of thing. And
that was the plant you showed me yesterday out in the swamp, right?
Yeah. So if you roll it between your fingers, it's very triangular in cross section. Yeah. So it tends to grow in very organic based soils, and it basically accumulates as peat over years and years and years of rotting vegetation sort of builds up this peat layer. So it doesn't have a real solid foundation, and therefore it's very vulnerable to erosion when nutria come in and start carving up that root mat.
Oh, okay.
So while muskrat do feed on the same types of plants, three square is very important for muskrat as well. They feed a little bit differently. Nutria tend to dig up the tubers, the roots of the plants,
yep.
And do it in a very concentrated area. And even more importantly, what they'll do is they'll dig swim channels, kind of like a beaver does, to get from the tidal waterways into their feeding areas. And what they're essentially doing is creating a little stream bed for the tide to get in and out.
Gotcha.
So it penetrates further into the marsh, and then when it comes out, all that material that they've dug up is gathered and swept out to sea, more or less, or at least out to the bay.
Oh, that's an because I was having a hard time picturing how what they were doing was causing so much trouble. That's an interesting perspective on it. Not a perspective on it, but like an interesting way to explain what's going on is those canals, like the same canals beavers dig. I never thought of that as being a way for water just to snake its way further up into stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. So you get higher salinity water penetrating further into what are typically brackish or even freshwater marshes.
Yeah, because beavers will dig those things. You'll see them 150, 200 yards long sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
To go access willow.
Right.
Yeah.
So that contributes to this erosion problem. What actually happens is that organic muck that this root mat is sort of floating on gets eroded from underneath, and the marsh begins to sink. And despite the fact that these are wetland plants, they're very susceptible to and intolerant of changes in the hydrology of the system. So all they need to sink is just a few fractions of an inch necessarily, and those plants can no longer survive. It turns into a different community. And in many cases, it sinks so low that no plants can survive, and it just turns into this kind of open water wasteland that really doesn't produce much good habitat. You know, it's not deep enough all the time for a fish community to be really supported by it. And most of the fish that we tend to see using those open water areas are also invasive species, carp and things like that. So, but it's not solely the Nutria's fault that we've seen such wetland loss in the Chesapeake Bay region, because there are a number of threats to this ecosystem, and that includes sea level rise, land subsidence through the withdrawal of our underground aquifers for human consumption, and irrigation, and all that sort of thing. And so there's all these sort of multiple factors impacting the marshes, which can be fairly resilient until you put Nutria into the equation. They're sort of the catalyst that your grandma's sweater that she knitted for you when you were a kid and you got a thread pulled on it and all of a sudden the whole thing unravels. The Nutria is the one pulling that thread. And that's all of the other things sort of compound when Nutria are introduced to the equation. So they did some really neat research back in the 1990s trying to figure out the role that Nutria played. And what they did was they went throughout the Blackwater system and they put in a bunch of fences, basically 30 by 30 meter exclusion fences that they buried into the ground so that the Nutria couldn't swim under it or dig under it. And then they made sure there were no Nutria within them. And they just monitored the vegetation around them. And they very quickly could see a distinct difference. They put them in areas where there was compromised by Nutria, and outside the fences continued to degrade and convert to this muddy open water. And inside the fence, the plants came back. So it was a good indication that if we could eliminate Nutria from the equation, that the marsh could possibly restore itself.
Now, real quick here, do they bank den, or where do they sleep at night?
That's a great question. They don't typically bank den. In fact, many of the areas that they live in out in the open marsh don't have banks. So they live on the surface.
They don't build a lodge or a hut like a muskrat or beaver.
They don't. And that's one of the reasons we think that they're limited in their northern distribution, because they don't have that thermal refuge from cold weather. So what we would see...
So they just lay out.
Yeah, they'll build like a little nest, just a platform of vegetation.
Like a muskrat feed bed kind
of
thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I've seen those built almost on stilts when we have real high water events. We had a hurricane in 2002, I think, Hurricane Isabel. It brought a 6-foot storm surge over the whole marsh. And when the waters receded, we found Nutria beds that were made out of Phragmites, that invasive reed that you've been seeing lately. 4 feet off the surface of the marsh, all folded over and made a nice little platform so they could get up out of the water.
Really?
But that doesn't provide thermal protection. So what we see in the wintertime with these critters is that they're very susceptible to cold weather. They'll get frostbite on their tails, and over the course of several years, a big adult Nutria might only have a stub 6-inch tail or less even, because it just gets frostbit. Females under physiological stress from the cold weather will actually abort their females or their fetuses.
Okay.
And so that's another element of Nutria, why they're such a difficult species to deal with, is because they reproduce extremely rapidly. They Nutria come into heat and are ready to breed within 24 to 48 hours of giving birth. And they become sexually mature at about 6 months of age. So once a Nutria hits 6 months of age, she's virtually pregnant for the rest of her life. And in the wintertime, if
let me clarify that.
Sure.
When you first said that, I thought you meant that the young, but you're saying a female will have a litter, and then that female within a couple days is ready to breed again.
Absolutely, yep.
And her offspring can breed when? How old are they?
At about 6 months of age.
Okay.
So you get, it's about a 4 month gestation period, 3 to 4 months. And so they can produce like 3 litters a year.
You're producing generations in a year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And in these northern climates where we do see these periods of stress on the animals where the females will abort their litters if they're pregnant, they'll come into heat immediately after that. So it forces this sort of cyclic and seasonality to the breeding pattern in these northern climates, where we tend to see big pulses of reproduction of litters born in like May, October, and January. And then usually the January litter doesn't really survive because these young are born at a time of year where it just isn't conducive to survival.
What year was it? Remind me again what year they first may have gotten introduced here.
About 1943, early 1940s.
And then what year was it when the explosion, like, you know, when you're describing how they'll just kind of putter along and all of a sudden their numbers get to a point where you can have this, like, all of a sudden this, like, exponential, you know, dynamite growth.
It was
growth.
The late 1960s when they really started to notice, you know, nutrient in abundance. And then through the 70s and 80s, that marsh loss really seemed to accelerate.
To the point where people were seeing it in their own lifetime, they were seeing the marsh loss.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I had employees on the project that were born and raised on the marshes of Blackwater. And they said when they were kids, they could have walked in tennis shoes from the wildlife drive on the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge across to the property where they grew up. It's about a 2 or 3 mile distance probably, and the only place they would have gotten wet was where the Blackwater River coursed through that marsh. It's a high marsh, solid, good ground, and that's a big lake now.
Okay.
Yeah.
What year was it then that, or let me ask this too, what year was it when someone said, like, is there something we should be trying to do about this? And how many Nutria were there at that moment?
Yeah, can you work in just like a general public perception into that answer too? Like, what was the public thinking about it back then?
Well, you know, at first I think that it wasn't perceived as such a problem because there was a fur market for Nutria. And people would go out in the wintertime and they would hunt and trap them and, you know, get some money for their pelts. excuse me. But really, from a wildlife perspective and from a local economy perspective, muskrat is the king here. And when you lose 3 square marsh, you lose muskrat. And I think people started to realize that at least from the trapping community, that muskrat are much more desirable than Nutria are. And so there was support even from, you know, that element that we needed to do something about it. The big thing was the loss of marshes at Blackwater and the surrounding Fishing Bay Wildlife Management area. So it was in the 1990s that the various natural resource agencies that have a role in managing and conserving these important Chesapeake Bay resources got together and started thinking about, you know, what we could do to try to stem the loss and maybe even foster the recovery of the marsh. This whole project is not about killing Nutria. It's about restoring wetlands. Mm-hmm. And that's the purpose of it. So it took some time to get all the people on board and to get congressional support for, because this is a big initiative. You know, we're talking, a 250,000 acres of wetlands that we eventually have treated across this this landscape. So no small task. They estimated population estimates somewhere in the vicinity of 50,000 nutria at Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. And they had some fairly good numbers to make estimates off through their trapping programs, because Blackwater and Fishing Bay are both available to for trappers to bid on. They control the amount of trapping.
I mean, the fur trappers can come in and bid on a lot, correct? Like a chunk of ground within the refuge to just to work for their own trap line,
right?
Yeah.
And so they had harvest records, and at one point they were paying not a bounty per se, but trappers that did lease the trapping units could turn in nutria tails for $1.50 credit towards the total price of whatever they paid. So if a trapper paid, you know, $1,500 for a trapping unit, and they caught, 100 nutria and turned the tails in, they could get $150 per tail and cover the cost of their lease. They couldn't catch, 500 nutria and get extra money.
But that same guy would probably be stacking up muskrats in the hundreds.
Oh yeah. Yeah, for sure. These wetlands support quite high densities of muskrats.
And these are high quality muskrats around here.
Yeah, the Chesapeake Bay region is renowned for the quality of their muskrat pelts.
Yeah, I heard a guy the other night. I mean, I remember in the late 70s, early 80s, muskrats, got up to extra large muskrats. You got to imagine the economic difference between now and then, what it meant. But $7 or $8 muskrats in the late 70s, early 80s, adjusted for inflation, is a valuable animal for something that an enterprising trapper. I mean, there was guys who would quite handily put trap flesh and stretch upwards of 1,000 or even more muskrats in a year. You could make a living trapping back then, trapping muskrats. Now you're hard pressed to make a living trapping muskrats. You're hard pressed to pay for your expenses trapping muskrats. But at the time, it was just an incredible thing. I caught the tail end of that. I was coming into trapping just as I set my first muskrat trap in 1984, and guys were already talking about the good old days.
Yeah,
but it was still pretty good, just not as good.
Right. And the market continues to fluctuate. We've never seen prices like back then, but in the time that I've been here, muskrat pelts, extra larges, have gone up to close to $8 and $5 with some regularity, and they peak and valley over time. But there's also a market for the meats here as well. So
that surprised me to hear.
Yeah, by the time you sell the pelt, and then you might get $3 or $4 or $5 for the meats as well, you're actually looking at $10 or $12 per muskrat. And there are people here that make a significant part of their living off of muskrat. It's a seasonal work. A lot of farmers will trap during the winter when they're not tending their fields and whatnot. A lot of watermen will trap during that part of the year. So it's an important part of the local economy. And a lot of people think that, trapping is a anachronistic type thing. It's a dead art, and we don't need it in this modern society, but there's still folks here that really rely on income for trapping. Dorchester County is not a wealthy county. It's the last time I looked, which was some years ago, the median income was about $22,000 a year. So if someone's catching $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 worth of muskrat in a year, that's a significant chunk of their annual income. So it's important to people. It's not just a hobby or a pastime that people like to do. It's really important. And this is a point that I think is forgotten, that those skills in the community, that understanding of the natural world that we live in, I think no one understands better than a trapper. Having know an animal well enough and its habitat well enough to be able to go out and catch it requires a certain amount of knowledge and know-how, understanding and respect for the environment. And without those,
to be out there doing that 90 days in a row.
Yeah, absolutely. Dedication. It's hard work. And having those skills, I think, are incredibly important to conservation today. And you can see it beyond what we did here. The nutria eradication campaign that we mounted in conjunction with the Maryland DNR and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, was essentially a systematic hunting and trapping program that we used paid employees to implement.
So the problem was identified and funding was secured, and someone floated the idea of, let's try to go kill all 50,000 nutria. Every last one of them dead.
Yep. That was the goal.
And what was the if someone told me, if you asked me like before I found out about this, if you'd asked me like, do you think not in an island environment, but like in an open environment like this, do you think you could mechanically remove an established population of a semi-aquatic rodent? I would tend to say no, you couldn't, but people did it successfully, accidentally, with beavers.
Exactly.
In the early 1900s.
Yeah, on horseback. So,
yeah.
So that was...
But it still would be daunting. Absolutely. I would still be like, yeah, I don't know if you could really do it or not.
And so, wisely, the project began as a pilot study because we weren't sure if it was feasible or not. And certainly there were a lot of people, probably most people, who thought it probably wasn't. But we were able to convince enough folks in the right places that it was a worthy endeavor. And we got the funding to do it. And it started with about a two-year research project back in 2000. And at that time, the project was being managed through the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, where they had a cooperative fish and wildlife research unit. It was part of the U.S. Geological Survey's research branch. And it started looking at things like trying to answer questions like, is there a density-dependent response of nutria reproduction in response to intensive trapping pressure? So in other words, if you trap nutria, are they going to just make more nutria faster? And so that was one of the areas of research.
Which is a problem people find with trying to get rid of coyotes.
Yeah, there are examples of species that do respond by increasing their reproductive rates, whether it's on a per individual basis by an increase in litter size, or if it's through an increasing proportion of the population breeding because you're disrupting the social dynamics of that species.
Gotcha.
And some do it by increasing dispersal too, right? When they get that pressure.
Yeah, well, that sort of ties into the disrupting their social thing. Oh, okay. You know, especially with coyotes. You know, if you have a saturated population of coyotes, they tend to suppress breeding in the younger animals, and they form more family groups. And if you get a lot of mortality there, then the family unit breaks up and the young disperse, and then you've got freedom to breed. So, but with nutria, the other thing they were looking at was trying to determine if there are any sort of parasite loads, that sort of thing, sort of some basic ecological research on how the species exists in the Chesapeake region, but also trying to estimate populations. And they found it challenging to catch enough animals to test some of their hypotheses with these things, because any marker capture study requires large sample sizes to come up with a reliable estimate of what that population is. And it got to a point where I think the folks that were providing the funding wanted to see us move into the eradication phase. You know, let's see if we can get this done.
Get out of the starting and get to the killing.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So in 2002, Wildlife Services was asked to get involved as the implementing agency to sort of carry out this plan. And it was very much an adaptive management type plan. And we started at Blackwater. That's where, you know, the problem originated. And we actually had three main study areas that were used during the research phase that we started out on. And one was at Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge. The other was on Fishing Bay Wildlife Management Area. And the third was on a private conservation property that was adjacent to the Fishing Bay and Blackwater complexes. So that first summer that we got engaged, you know, we worked on trying to trap out the study areas that they had started doing all this research on.
And those weren't like enclosed areas, though.
No, no, not at all.
And they weren't isolated. No. They were tied into the other populations.
Correct, correct. So they were, as I remember, they were about 600, 700, 800, 900 acres, sort of plots within the Blackwater Fishing Bay and Tudor Farms system. And that's where they had done the bulk of the mark and recapture studies and that sort of thing. So we tried to go in and work out our trapping techniques to sort of clear out those areas and try to give some closure to the mark recapture stuff so that we could get all those tagged animals and account for them.
Would this be a good time to explain how the, like, I have no idea when you just say you're trapping nutria, like, what did that look like?
Yeah, sure. So we use some pretty conventional fur trapping techniques. The core of our trapping toolbox was the 220 Conibear, which is an instant kill body gripping trap. It's commonly
pretty used. Near instant.
Pretty near, yes.
Submerged, it's fast.
Yes, it is. So, you know, we bought thousands of those things.
Is that right?
Yeah, we had 15 full-time wildlife specialists.
Do you guys remember if you're running like Victor's or Northwoods or just whoever?
Yeah, I think Sleepy Creek, actually. I think we had quite a few traps from them. Yeah.
Yeah, body gripping traps come in like series sizes. So like there's like the 100 series sizes, right, which are mink and muskrat. 200 series sizes are generally used for raccoon, otter, nutria, exactly. Fishers. Guys will use 110s on dry land, 110s for marten. Did I say mink? I think I did. Then the 300 series are usually just beaver.
Yeah.
But guys use 330s also for wolverines. Mm-hmm. And some guys liked like 330s for otters because otters are harder to fence into a 220, but they don't work right as good because sometimes the otter can pop out of one of the jaws, right, you know, so people right like the 220s on those.
Yep.
So, do they make any bigger or is that the biggest?
Never heard of anything bigger than the 330 Conibear or 300 series Conibear.
They actually do make a couple, what do they call them, 660s or something like that, and it's like two 330s welded together, so it's still got the 10-inch jaw spread from top to bottom, but they're twice as wide.
Yeah, that's good to throw in the measurements, because the 220s are 8, right?
7 inches, I believe.
7-inch jaw spread, okay. Yeah, when you set this thing, this looks like a little wire box.
Right.
Right, and but it's got springs on. The 330, you could break your arm, man, if you put your arm in.
Yeah, they're not pleasant to have your appendage cut in.
So you guys went out and bought a mountain of 220s.
We bought a mountain of 220s and quite a few foothold traps as well.
And what were you doing up with those? What size traps?
A lot of 1.5 coil spring traps, but we also use some bigger. So Nutria have a much bigger hind foot than they do front foot, very much like a beaver. And so the 1.5 coil spring trap, which has about a 4.5-inch jaw spread, I think Nutria's foot can span the entire trap. So unless you catch them by the front foot, you run the risk that they might just spring the trap and not get caught. So we did have some larger traps that we used, number twos and threes, I think, that we sometimes set.
If you were set for the hind leg?
Yeah.
Yeah. So just for context for people, like a 1.5 double coil spring is a foothold trap. And that's the size generally used. That's like the go-to trap for raccoon, fox.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
That size critter.
Yep. So, and it's important to have different tools in your trapping toolbox because sometimes animals become trap shy. You know, if they see a certain type of trap and they're, you know, some animals are less tolerant of new novelties in their environment and they'll sort of steer clear of them. So foothold trap is easier to camouflage and sort of disguise. So we tended to catch the bulk of the animals that we captured in the 220 Conibear, but when we had animals that were clearly, you know, avoiding the body gripping traps, we would set the foothold traps.
And were you setting those 220s in the channels?
Yeah, so we'd find those swim channels and paths through the marsh.
And just neck them down and stay there.
They're the perfect width.
So they build a 220-size channel?
Yep. perfect width for the 220. It wasn't quite rocket science to catch him, but
and would you guys use those basic harness rigs to hold the 220 so you can just stab it into the ground?
No, we actually used bamboo poles mostly. So we wired the trap to a bamboo pole and then stuck it through the spring in the corner of the trap to provide some stabilization and also sort of a visual sort of guide to send the animal through.
And you're hauling all this gear around what, a canoe?
A lot of it, well, yeah, mostly John boats, actually. There are the main waterways you can navigate through the marsh, but a lot of it was over the shoulder, just carrying stuff through the equipment through the marsh. The bamboo poles were kind of handy because you could spring the trap on the end of the bamboo pole and then gather, 10 or a dozen poles up with traps on it and throw them over your shoulder and carry them across the marsh. So, and it's stuff like that. Kind of circle back to where I was going with the importance of maintaining these trapping skills in the community. We were very reliant on local knowledge and local trappers on this project to understand how to work in this marsh effectively and the techniques that work best. Because while trapping isn't rocket science, it's got a steep learning curve for a beginner, and it can take people a long time to sort of figure things out. And an experienced trapper can be very effective at selecting the species that they're trying to target and avoiding those other species that not. But a novice trapper often is not as selective. So having that expertise in the community, and this translates to much, much beyond, nutria eradication. Fur trappers were incredibly important to the restoration of a lot of endangered species in the United States, wolves being probably one of the most prime examples of that. The last remaining Mexican wolves were caught by a trapper named Roy McBride and pulled into captivity for a selective breeding program to build those populations up and restore them to the wild. The Yellowstone wolf recovery effort was, many of those wolves were captured and traps set by trappers.
So, I remember some years ago, some American fur trappers going down to help some governments in South America catch jaguars.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, they're, a good trapper is a very valuable person to the wildlife conservation community. So,
were you a trapper before you got involved with wildlife services?
Yeah, he was trading muskrats for haircuts.
Yep.
Okay, yeah. I caught that.
So I wasn't certainly not a trapper in the sense that the folks here that, make a living off it, but how I got started in it. And actually I grew up with somewhat of a negative opinion of trapping because my grandfather was an avid bird hunter and always had bird dogs.
Oh yeah. Those guys.
And he'd had a couple dogs get caught in foothold.
They're
traps.
Right there with the Humane Society. trapping, man.
So yeah, he had sort of instilled in me this, lack of appreciation, shall I say, for trapping in general. But, I went to school for wildlife management and I came out of that and went into graduate school for wildlife ecology. And I was really dying to study carnivores. And I managed to land a graduate research position at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry doing coyote research. And, for the first time I had to figure out how to catch an animal with this sort of traditional fur harvesting tools. I'd done, trapping with cage traps for pine marten and other critters like that, but I'd never
for research. Set,
for research, yeah. But I'd never set, foothold traps. And so I had to learn how to do it to catch study animals for my project. And when you're making, a stipend of $800 a month, it doesn't quite make ends meet. And I'm learning to trap, and I'm also driving through all of this prime muskrat country, and I'm seeing farmers with problems with beavers and all that sort of stuff. And so I just started learning, and I was very fortunate to have a renowned fur buyer and trapper in the community that I was living in upstate New York.
Who was that?
Paul Grimshaw.
Yeah, Grimshaw. They make lures, too.
Yep. And he didn't exactly take me under his wing. He's kind of a ornery old guy. But once you sort of connected with him, he'd start sharing knowledge. And so I learned a tremendous amount from him. I'd just go and watch he and his wife skin and stretch muskrat pelts and just learned, you know, the kind of tricks of the trade for catching some of these other fur bears. And I was able to supplement my income, you know, not tremendous. I wasn't out there buying cars or anything with it. But when you make $800 a month, an extra month's salary and in the course of a year, it really helped out quite a bit. So
I was telling Giannis the other day about I used to sell. I didn't flash and stretch my own raccoons. Mm-hmm. He's like, no one likes doing that, you know. And I would sell them to a fur buyer guy named Abe Salicina. He was a tomato enthusiast who grew tomatoes and bought fur. And he would go into to sell him raccoons, and he'd be in there, and mm-hmm. he'd heat his barn with raccoon fat.
No kidding.
Yeah, just, he'd open that door and take a gob of that raccoon fat, throw it in there, like black smoke coming out of that.
Well, you know, it was neat to be in such proximity to Paul Grimshaw because, you know, he was an expert in putting up furs and whatnot. So, mm-hmm. you know, I put up my own fur from when I was doing that, and I enjoyed that part of it. It's kind of like butchering your own meat, you know, you're kind of taking that process from start to finish, and you know, you get more money for when it's put up properly. You get less when it's put up poorly, but I think they'd rather buy green fur than poorly put up fur. But
yeah, so that's like that like lingo is green fur would be skinned,
right,
but not flesh and stretch. If you sold a muskrat, like guys would also sell muskrats in the round,
right?
Which would mean just
whole
freaking muskrat. Yeah, yeah, just pull up at the end, run your line, and drive up and sell a guy muskrats in the round. You might be selling them for half what you'd get if you sold them
right
stretched.
Exactly. So that was a real learning experience for me, and the thing I liked about it is that it really makes you step back and take time to learn about animals you normally wouldn't even think about. You know, who thinks about muskrats? Unless you're trying to catch them. And then, so I learned a whole lot about the ecology of the region and the behavior of the animals and the importance of different habitat types and what lives there through this process of learning how to trap. And
when you caught wind of you had to go apply for the nutria job, or was it, it just like fall into your lap?
No, I had to apply for it. You know, when I was working in the Virginia Wildlife Services program, every state has Wildlife Services has a program in every state, just about. And so I was working through the Virginia Division of Wildlife Services, and we would have these annual conferences where all the different states surrounding would get together and intermingle. And for a couple of years there, I was hearing them talk about this nutria eradication study that they were undertaking in Maryland. And at the time, Maryland Wildlife Services wasn't getting involved. We had a state director at the time that was close to retirement, and I think wasn't really all that keen to take on this sort of massive project. But he retired, and a new guy came in and jumped on the opportunity to work with the Fish and Wildlife Service and put this vacancy announcement out there. And geez, it sounded interesting to me. I had no idea what a nutria was. I had to look it up. And I put my name in the hat, and I don't know how I got picked, but I did.
Because you had a bunch of trapping experience.
Yeah, I guess so. But I feel very fortunate to have been selected for that position, because it's the kind of thing that doesn't happen too often in your career, where you get to work on a project that just has sort of profound impacts on conservation and the ecology and results that you can see on the ground. And so the position was...
And it was everything you liked, man.
Yeah, I was able to take all of the skills that I developed through my personal passions, hunting and trapping and that sort of thing, and sort of devote them to solving a conservation problem. And it really was rewarding to be able to do that. And also, you know, I have to give full credit to the guys and gals that really got this job done, because I was not the trapper out there. I did trap some, but I was a project manager, so I was supervising the team,
big coming up,
developing the strategies to, you know, how to work and devote our resources across the landscape, and, you know, when is it time to move from this area to that area, that sort of thing. Making sure the guys had all the equipment that they needed, the boats, the motors, the waders, the traps, all that stuff. So that was sort of my role. And, you know, the opportunity to supervise was appealing to me. I didn't think so when I first got into wildlife that I'd really want to be managing people. But, you know, realizing how much more you can accomplish by harnessing the energy of others was a neat opportunity. So
I'm getting backed up on questions. I got a couple quickies.
Sure.
Out of context, out of order. Were you hiring trappers, or were you hiring, or did that not, that's not how it worked? Like, you didn't come in and hire existing fur trappers,
so
to do the physical trapping.
So the research phase of the project had hired some local trappers as part of the team, and when we came
to develop methodologies or whatever.
Yeah, well, to implement the research study that they designed. Okay. So that was primarily using cage traps and some foothold traps. But they did reach out to the local community and got a handful of folks that were, you know, born and raised in the Chesapeake Bay, knew how to trap, how to handle animals and all that stuff. And so we inherited, when the Wildlife Services Program took over, they wanted to provide a home for those, you know, employment for those folks that had dedicated themselves to the research phase of the project. And so we were able to hire them when we came on board. Not all of them chose to come with us, so I had some vacancies to fill, and, you know, we put out vacancy announcements, and we tried to recruit locally, and we also tried to recruit young wildlife professionals that were just getting out of college and starting their careers. And I always strove to have a sort of a balance of the two, because those greenhorns don't know what they're doing, and they need someone to kind of show them the ropes and whatnot, but they bring a lot of energy and passion to their work as well.
And it helps them in their career path.
It's a stepping stone for them.
More impactful work,
And then our sort of, I always call them our veteran employees. They weren't military veterans necessarily, but the folks that had been with the project from the beginning, and our folks that were taught on the Chesapeake. They went to the school of the Chesapeake, you know, to learn their trade. And so those folks would provide kind of the stability and the long-term institutional knowledge that we needed to keep the project going, because this is a long-term project.
And so the second quickie, then I'm going to get into the longer question. What are you guys doing with all the nutrients that you trap? You probably can't utilize them, right? Because it's part of a government project.
Correct. So, and there was no market for them or anything like that. There's no use for the meats or anything. So at first we were instructed to remove all of the carcasses from the field, and we were going to compost them or bury them or do something. Pardon me. But we quickly found, and at this time that sort of rule was put in place, we had expected that there would be tens of thousands of nutria that we were going to be catching. And when reality set in, we started doing the trapping, it had become clear that the population had begun to decline, and we weren't catching nearly the numbers that we expected. That
began
we would.
To decline because of the trapping?
No, not necessarily. I think the population on its own had started sort of dwindling, and part of the reason is probably that they had eaten themselves out of house and home in many of these areas, so there's habitat that was no longer there. They were estimated to reach densities of, gosh, I should have boned up on some of my memory here. 6 to 9 per square acre or per acre. Okay. So at those densities, which are tremendous densities, you know, you could have seen 35 to 50,000 nutrient blackwater, but wipe 5,000 acres of habitat off the map, and you've got significantly fewer. So we were bringing the carcasses back, but there weren't that many of them. And the big concern for removing them from the marsh was the potential for avian botulism with all these rotting carcasses out there potentially.
Being fed on by birds.
Yeah, just this mass of carrion that would potentially create problems for other wildlife.
Yep.
But it was very time-consuming to remove the animals from the field. You know, at 15 pounds a piece, you get four or five of them. You've got 60 pounds of carcass that you're hauling around. So it was impeding our progress. And it didn't seem like there were numbers that would contribute to the kind of concerns that we initially had going into it. So we opted at that point to leave the carcasses out in the field, and very quickly the scavengers would convert them back to, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Yeah. And so it didn't turn out to be so much of an issue to have to remove them from the field, and that freed us up to, you know, better to spend our time moving traps and carrying more traps out than carrying...
Deal with all those carcasses.
Yeah, exactly.
So the longer question... No, I got another quickie. What was the public perception of the idea that we're going to kill all the nutria, just get rid of them wholesale?
Great.
Were people like, good idea? Or were people like, that's a horrible idea? Not whether you can, not whether it's plausible, but whether it's like advisable.
Right. So anytime you implement some sort of lethal management of wildlife populations, there's often a outcry of public sentiment that opposes that. But because of the ecological impact that these critters had, and it was obvious to anyone familiar with this ecosystem, the ecological justification was so compelling that there was really very little backlash. Add to that that it's basically a 20-pound rat. Doesn't generate a whole lot of sympathy.
But I wasn't more. Yeah, that's good information, and I like that you said it. But I meant I wasn't so much interested in those guys. I was interested in the people who actually liked the nutria. Oh. But so, yeah, no, do both versions. I hadn't even anticipated.
Sure.
You're talking about like the animal welfare,
right?
Because there was a very, I'm talking about the guys who were out there, perhaps hunting, trapping, eating, selling.
So again, back to muskrat is the king. Nutria had a pretty detrimental impact on muskrat populations, both through elimination of habitat and competition, displacement competition. So nutria would, in the winter months in particular, dig into muskrat houses to try to seek refuge from cold weather, or sit on top of them and bask in the sun and whatnot. And they would basically destroy the muskrat house for the muskrats. So, you know, we had a less valuable critter having a negative impact on a really important critter. And so there was really no opposition.
So there was really no one who had any kind of reasonable, widespread sentiment that you should...
We had, you know, one landowner that I worked with, and that's something I should mention too, is that this project would have been inconceivable without the support of private landowners, because more than half of the nutria that we eventually removed came from private land. So having their support was critical. As a federal agency, a non-regulatory, Wildlife Services can't just go on private property and conduct our work. We have to have their permission and blessing, and they have to approve all the methods that we use. So I had one farmer that we encountered who refused us access to his property because, according to what he said, was he liked to eat nutria and liked to have them, a little refrigerator out in the back 40 where he could go and pluck some nutria for dinner on occasion. Fortunately, it wasn't a big area, and we were able to sort of trap around it and kind of pull the animals that were on his property off, so it didn't impede our progress in the long term. But what it mostly come down to, I think, is there's a fairly significant anti-government sentiment in the community just about anywhere you go, but it's particularly noticeable here in Dorchester County. You know, there's a lot of government regulations with, you know, wetlands and harvest of animals, fish, commercial fisheries and crabs and all that sort of thing. So there's just this sort of general resentment to government intrusion and people's livelihoods.
People want to be able to wreak havoc and not have any repercussions.
Right. So there wasn't that opposition. And then from the animal welfare side, there also wasn't opposition, which is interesting because at the same time that we were undertaking this eradication campaign, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources was trying to deal with a rapidly expanding mute swan population that had reached
another non-native species.
Another non-native species that does an aquatic ecosystems very much what nutria do to these wetland ecosystems. So they feed on the mute swans feed on the subaquatic submerged aquatic vegetation that's really critical habitat for all sorts of fish, crabs, and you know, it's, it provides a nursery for all these juvenile species. And they'll go in.
So folks can imagine, we're talking about, imagine the most beautiful,
exactly,
picturesque swan,
yep,
that you would just want to protect and cuddle.
Exactly.
Like take pictures of and cuddle with.
Yep, and they had reached populations.
The bastard of the marsh, man.
They had reached populations of close to 4,500 animals.
And explain their impact on ducks.
So they're very aggressive birds, and they will chase native waterfowl and shorebirds and displace them off of nesting grounds and feeding grounds and stuff. So they're pretty.
Yeah, they don't play nice, man.
No, they don't play
nice.
So he's
like, you know, I'm going to nest here, and no one's going to nest within 100 yards of my nest.
Yep, exactly. And so in response to that initiative that the Department of Natural Resources was taking on, there were animal welfare groups erecting billboards along Route 50, save our swans, and messages to the governor, and so on.
Screw the ducks, save the swans, man.
Exactly. So, to their credit, the DNR persisted, and they have whittled that population down, last I heard, to probably less than 50.
Okay.
So, we got two big ecological problems that have been, you know, dealt with in this region over the past 10, 15 years.
And a lot of that anti-sentiment went into swans and not into rodents.
Yeah, it was perhaps a bit of a distraction, but, you know, I think that there's an element. A lot of these groups are reliant on donations for their solvency. Yep. And people are much more willing to open their wallet for a big, beautiful white bird than a brown 20-pound rat.
But isn't it weird because you're kind of defending... I mean, it's not weird at all because people are people, and mm-hmm. you look at things and you know, we tend to like and admire animals that strike us as beautiful.
Sure.
But... If you're based on the idea that you're just defending sentient life, mm-hmm. like you don't want to see damage come to sentient life, it shouldn't matter if it's a swan or a giant rodent. It's like it's a sentient being.
Yeah. A man is a pig, is a dog, is a boy.
But people really tend to get very interested in defending things that are, you know, Instagram-worthy creatures, mm-hmm. more so than the ugly ones.
Well, and the cynic in me says it's, you know, it's driven more by money than it is by by commitment to the cause.
Because that's where you get funding.
Right.
Yeah.
Who's gonna pull out their wallet to save nutria?
Yeah.
So we were fortunate not to have to battle that sort of opposition to the program. And much to our surprise, when we started reaching out to private landowners, when we kind of expected, given the government sentiments, anti-government sentiments, that we would have a hard time, people were opening their doors to us. You know, I can't tell you how many kitchens I sat in with my laptop computer and a little slideshow talking to farmers and other landowners about what we were attempting to do and why it was important for their assistance and whatnot. And hundreds of landowners gave us access to tens of thousands of private acres of private property so that we could be successful in this. And a lot of them did it sort of begrudgingly. You know, they didn't think we'd be successful.
They think you'd catch them all.
No, hell no. You'll never get the last one. I don't even know why you guys are wasting all this government money on there, but as one farmer I remember distinctly said, but I'm not going to be the stick in the mud to keep you guys from trying. So, you know, and we had a couple key landowners that came on board early that sort of helped us set the stage and, you know, well, if so-and-so let you on his property, I guess I'll let you on mine.
Yeah.
And I think one of the most, the biggest compliments I ever got working on this project over the 12 years that I was on it was from that farmer that said he didn't want to be the stick in the mud to stand in the way of trying to do this. But he had told me that there's no way in hell we were ever going to get the last ones or probably even make a dent in the population. And a couple of years after we had sort of swept through his area, I ran into him at a gas station. He came up to me, he said, you know, I never thought I'd say this, but I've got to eat some crow here. He said, I never thought you guys could have done what you did eliminating those nutria. So I've been out, and he was a bird hunter, and he would take his dogs, and he used to take his labs out and hunt nutria in the marshes behind his house. And he said, I haven't seen a nutria in 2 years, and I don't know where they all went, but how you guys did it, but you know, it's an amazing thing that you've accomplished here. So, and it, you know, it wasn't like we just went out and trapped one time and removed it. It was a constant effort of going back and sweeping through and looking and making sure that we didn't leave anything behind.
Well, back up to the first, when you first isolated a test area and went for it, how long, like roughly how big was the test area and how long did it take to wipe out the test area? And then how did you monitor it to see that you'd gotten them all?
So the test area began with these original 600-acre parcels or study sites, three of each. I think there were a total of, I can't even remember now. There were three study sites on each property. And so we went in and we just intensively trapped them off. We created a grid across the entire study site, and then we deployed our trappers in sort of rows and columns like a checkerboard type thing, and then we trapped across and saturated the whole area with traps. But these were basically islands in a sea of occupied habitat. Yeah, yeah. So we very quickly could tell that it's just immigration. We were creating a big population sink, but that if we were really going to do this and test the feasibility of eradication on a landscape scale, we couldn't do it on these little 600-acre plots. So we finished those out just to provide closure to that research project. And then we sort of reimagined the whole landscape. And starting at the western edge of Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge, we created a huge grid over that entire landscape, 40 acres, about 400 meters or yards per side was the size of these trapping units. And we would stack our trappers up in these rows, and they would work east to west or west to east across the marsh, sequentially trapping each trapping unit, each grid square. So we basically had a swath of intensive trapping activity that kind of moved across the landscape. We call it Rolling Thunder because it sounded cool.
Right? So how many traps was Rolling Thunder running per night, and how many nutria were you stacking up per day?
So we set pretty heavily at the beginning. There were a lot of nutria to catch. We wanted to remove them as quickly as possible. And so we would have hundreds. Each employee could have a couple hundred traps out at any given time. So with 15 employees working on it, you know, we had a couple thousand traps out at any given point in time. And so what we'd do is we'd set the first row or column of trapping grids up. And then once that was saturated and things started to catch, you know, you'll see a really, you'll catch a lot of animals at first, and then it'll start to dwindle off and tail off.
Yep.
So when we started to see that dwindling in the first row, we'd start taking some of those traps and rolling them into the second row and getting that one set up. So we just kind of leapfrogged ourselves along, and it worked quite well. And what we did looking at the numbers is that, and this was one of the things that we tried to do at the very beginning in the research phase, was this mark recapture population estimate. We found it was actually much more accurate to just go out and remove all the animals in one fell swoop and count them all. And what it turns out is that we could trap out a particular grid in about 3 weeks' time.
Okay.
And, you know, so we would catch, looking at the numbers over time, we'd catch about 75% of all the animals that occupied that plot in the first week of trapping. By the end of the second week, we'd captured 85 to 90%. By the end of the third week, we've trapped about 95%. And then we would continue to catch onesies and twosies for that remaining 5% over the, it might take an additional 4 weeks to get all those.
So if you rolled into a new area that was real hot, and you did a main set, and you got a few hundred traps in the water, what might the first catch be? Like, what percent of traps would be full?
Well, it depended on the trapper. There's a lot of variability there. You know, some of the more experienced trappers would set fewer and more targeted, and others would set more broadly and try to catch them all at once. And I, honestly, I can't tell you. I remember anybody that had a double-digit day was feeling pretty good about their efforts. Yeah.
You know, it's a thing that I think of from when I used to trap muskrats is that when you went into an area, you couldn't if you were being like forward-thinking, you wouldn't run more than two or you'd never run more than two or three nights because if you went into a marsh and I used to trap a lot of isolated potholes, okay. So if you went into a marsh and set up, and it's like I got a good number of muskrats, the first night you might, so the first night's catch, so you sat during the day, let them sit overnight, check them the next day. That night you might run 60 to 75% full traps. I mean, if you knew what you were doing, right?
Yep.
The next night you're going to go back and that's going to drop down to 25%. If you were like a smart guy thinking about next year's season, you'd pull at that point.
Yep, absolutely.
I could imagine, and I know you never did this because it wasn't practical and there was no motivation to do it, but I could imagine just now here, listening to you, just imagine like, yeah, if you stayed in that marsh for 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and kept running all those sets, you could absolutely.
Yeah.
But there, you're talking about isolated spots. That's hard. I mean, they obviously got there in the first place, but it's a, you know, it's not a matter of them just swimming over to your area. They have to do it across land spring. You know, they'll migrate in the spring. But yeah, man, thinking about it now, I could totally picture you could just like, but just for 3 weeks, nothing. Oh, here's another one. Nothing. Exactly. Here's another one. You'd eventually just probably get them.
And so that is the most critical component. You know, there are a number of factors that you have to meet, criteria you have to meet for eradication of any species to be feasible. So, you know, in an eradication campaign like this, a trapping-based eradication campaign, that's sort of like all the other kind of management things you hear about, that 80% of your energy is spent on 20% of this or whatnot. And what we found out is that like 80 or 90% of our energy was spent capturing the last few animals in a population.
They'd get trap shy on you.
They get trap shy, and it's just, you know, it gets down to fewer animals leave less signs. So where exactly are they? And then it's a lot of activity on the marsh, so their behavior will change. They'll change the way they use the marsh, and they'll move in different times of the year. They're, you know, in the summertime, they can go anywhere they want because there's an abundance of food everywhere. So, you know, you'd find a little pocket and you'd set traps and then you'd not catch anything and find that they'd moved 200 yards. And so you got to go find them.
And are you guys toting around 22s as well and just shooting them when you see them?
Yeah. In the winter months in particular, we would do systematic hunting. So when the marsh froze up.
I like the sounds of that.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means. But
When the marsh would freeze in the wintertime, if we were so lucky to get that and a little dusting of snow, we could shoot a lot of nutria in a short amount of time just getting out on that marsh and hunting them, you know. So that whole concept of all of this energy being consumed using, you know, catching the last few animals really forced us to think about kind of different strategies to find those remaining animals. And one of the things that you mentioned earlier, you asked if there was any opposition, and there actually was a little bit. there were some folks that thought that we should just offer a bounty and that the local trappers would take care of the problem if you offer a bounty.
Yeah, but they're only gonna, they're not gonna chase after the last 20%.
Exactly. And so that was why we elected to, we're essentially paying people to check empty traps. You know, the stuff they caught at the beginning, well, that's the easy part. The hard part is catching the last few, and that's where we need to keep that effort going. And so the trick became how to find more efficiently those last remaining animals, and we tried a number of different things to do that. One of those was utilizing Nutria themselves to find other Nutria. So I had gone to some conferences and met with some folks that work internationally on invasive species eradication campaigns and whatnot. And in the Galapagos, they'd used Judas goats. So they had these goats that they captured and put radio collars on them or GPS collars, and they let them go. They're a social and gregarious creature, so they seek out other goats, and they would go up in a helicopter and find these Judas goats that they put out there, and then take out all of the other animals that
all the new friends that he'd made.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, knowing that Nutria were social and sought out other Nutria, I thought, oh, I wonder if this could work for us. So we actually
hold on. Pardon my ignorance, but where does the Judas
what
that reference come from? Some kind of Bible?
Did you grow up like some kind of pagan household?
You guessed it.
That's right. You did grow up some kind of pagan household. So Judas betrayed Christ. Yeah, in the Last Supper painting, he's the only one that won't look at it. He's the only one not looking at Christ.
All right.
Yeah, betrayed him to the Romans.
I'm glad he's here as the historian to answer that question. I know it was biblical, but I don't like to go too deep into that biblical stuff. So thank you.
Well, there you have it.
Providing that insight. But yeah, so we
captured. Now you ever hear of a fellow by the name of Moses?
Yeah, I heard of him.
I just didn't know how deep we had to dive here.
So we actually got a special grant to look at whether or not this concept would be feasible, because we didn't want to sort of detract from the ongoing efforts to trap and remove by diverting funds. So we got some additional grant funding to support this effort from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and we captured a bunch of Nutria. We had them surgically sterilized because we didn't want to be releasing animals that could then, you know, escape us and begin breeding out there. As quickly as they breed, we knew that could be a problem, as well as a perception issue. You know, here we are spending millions of dollars to try
put
to
more back out.
Yeah. So they were all surgically sterilized. The males were vasectomized, and the females had a tubal ligation.
Yeah, I had the former.
Yeah. And then we put radio collars, and in some instances, they also had a GPS collar on them that stored the data that it collected on board. So at the time, the technology was still pretty limiting that we couldn't, you know, these devices take a lot of power, and power means big batteries, and putting a big package on a smaller animal, was especially one that's got the body conformation of a Nutria, is challenging. So we had these little devices custom made by a company in New Zealand that made them rechargeable, and they would collect data for about a month, and then it would store it all on board, and we'd go back out and catch those animals and retrieve that GPS unit and download it, and we could see everywhere that Nutria had been. Every 90 minutes it would collect a location. We could see where it had been over the past month.
And he's an unfamiliar terrain when you turn him loose.
Correct. Yeah. So the intent here was to determine if we left Nutria behind in areas we already trapped. So we would release them into areas that we thought were devoid of Nutria. Well, lo and behold, some of these animals started moving pretty widely across the landscape. They also, the collar also had a standard radio transmitter, so we could actually go out and track it on a day-to-day basis, so we would at least know the general vicinity they were in. And we noticed, you know, after some wide movements across the landscape.
Like miles?
Miles, yeah, okay. In some cases. Once they sort of sort of conglomerated into a smaller area, I thought, well, I wonder if there could be other nutria there. You know, it's spending a lot of time in this one area. So we'd go out and we'd set our cage traps to try to catch these animals back. And lo and behold, we caught a few animals that were not tagged. I was like, oh, this could work.
In areas you thought you had trapped out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So we knew there was a likelihood there were probably some animals, but you know, we'd done the initial knockdown and we'd gone back through and sort of mopped up. Those are kind of terminologies we use to describe the different phases of the eradication campaign. Yep. And so it wasn't a complete surprise to us, but it sure was handy to know where they were from these critters. But the problem that we had tracking them on a daily basis with their radio collars is that because they moved so far and because it's a thick vegetation environment and they're often in the water, so the signal from that device doesn't travel that far, you had to be pretty close to even detect the signal. So in cases where they might have moved 2 or 3 miles overnight, we would spend all day, you know, trying to find them again.
Trying to find them. I got you.
And so it turned out that while the technique worked to expose the existence of other nutria in the environment, from an operational standpoint, it wasn't really practical. I mean, the human resources that it took to just keep up with these animals. So what would have really been valuable was to have had a GPS collar that could, through either cell phone technology or satellite technology, relay that information to us remotely. And then, so that exists for a lot of different species that it can carry that additional battery power.
That much extra equipment. I want to ask you a question that's not related to nutria, but is related to tracking devices. So let's just say that you know that in your state there is a collaring program going on with elk. And you know there are some elk wearing collars. What prevents a person who just likes to tinker with kind of stuff, what prevents a person from finding, from building up his own kit to go track those same animals, just to find out where elk herds are so he can go hunt them?
So a couple things make it difficult. It's certainly not impossible, and that's, you know, been an issue in places, I'm sure. But the FCC designates certain bandwidths for government research, and you know, you can get these kinds of devices for hunting dogs and that sort of thing. So they sort of segregate the use categories of the different bandwidths, so the megahertz or frequencies that these things emit on. And so the systems that are used for wildlife tracking are not generally available to the public. It's fairly expensive too, so it doesn't happen too often, but it certainly can happen.
Yeah, and there's no so there would be a component of law would come into it, that you're using frequencies you're not supposed to use, or is that just,
you know, I don't know.
I've never even had anybody say to me that they were trying to do this. It's just always puzzled me that I was wondering if you would be like breaking a law to go out with a receiver of some sort and be like, and also sort of tracking collared animals the same way that a researcher is tracking them.
Well, and so we had an interesting thing there. I'm not sure about the legality of it, but researchers in general keep a really tight lid on collar frequencies. You know, it's not information that they share readily. So they keep that pretty close to the vest so that you don't have problems like that. But yeah,
the reason I first started thinking about this is, remember your friend up in Fairbanks who had all those moose collared. Mm-hmm. And one day I made a joke being like, I bet there's a lot of dudes in Fairbanks that like to track those moose with you. Because she just had ones that were out in huntable areas, mm-hmm. You know. So, sorry, go ahead.
Well, so the way the government, the FCC, divvies up these bandwidths, so like the federal government gets, you know, 164 dot whatever, and private or academic institutions get a totally different bandwidth. So in theory, you shouldn't have all of this sort of overlapping. You know, when I call up a telemetry company and say, order a bunch of collars, I don't get to pick and choose my frequencies, but I can be relatively assured that someone else who's doing research in the same area through a university is not going to be anywhere close to where I am because they're on a totally different bandwidth.
Okay.
But it turns out that you can get these errant signals. They're basically harmonics. I don't know exactly how it works, but there was another study going on in the area where we were doing our Judas project that was looking at Sika deer. And so they had a whole bunch of collars on Sika deer, and we had a whole bunch of collars on Nutria, and we were working in the same general area. And so we were out there looking one day, and we got a nice strong signal on one of our Nutria, and we're going through, and it's an area that we'd trapped out. We had a beautiful frozen marsh, snow all over the place, and we're tracking this thing down, and we kept bumping the Sika deer, and there were like no tracks in the snow from Nutria. And we were like, what the heck is going on here? And so we started doing a little more digging. And finally, I called the graduate student that was doing that project up. I said, do you by any chance have a Sika deer down in this area? And he said that he did. And I asked him what the frequency was. And it was way off. I mean, it shouldn't even have been detectable on our radio system. But as it turns out, it was. We were getting these weird harmonics that would, even though it was the wrong system, it still came in on our radio. Oh, man, we had a whole bunch of data we had to throw out because it just we couldn't be sure
really?
That what we were tracking was Nutria versus Sika deer. So it was a little bit of a learning curve there.
Oh, but that's interesting. Yeah.
But it was really neat to be able to see how these animals use the landscape. Different animals released in different areas would move across the Blackwater refuge system. And it was amazing how similarly they use the landscape. You know, there are certain points that almost every animal that we released, no matter where we released them, would pass by. So it gave us some insights on how we might utilize those points as either trapping sites or detection sites.
So you're saying the way that the animals would be somehow funneled by the topography or landscape, exactly. And whatever they're looking for, yep. would bring them by the.
Yep.
What would those features be? Points of
points
of land or channels,
confluence of two tributaries, any sort of point that sticks out. It was.
It'd give you a good idea to where to look in the future.
Yep, exactly.
So did it start to have as the project went along? And you started to sort of get the sense like, holy shit, we maybe are going to catch them all.
Yeah.
Did it feel like a hard stop, or was it just like this kind of like gradual wind down?
Well, we had a lot of real estate to cover. So, you know, when it was winding down in one area, we would move to another area. So, you know, we'd get these sort of peaks and valleys in our capture rates, and that helped keep the staff sort of motivated because, you know, even though their job is eradication, most trappers evaluate their success by how many critters they catch. And when you're trying to catch something that's not there, it's a pretty frustrating and morale busting.
No, I would be, if I had that job, I'd be real excited every time we moved into a new area.
Oh yeah, and the guys were. But eventually, we hit all the known populations, and it became this just drudgery of kind of looking and looking and looking. And so when you're relying on an observer-based system to find an animal, it's like looking for Bigfoot, you know? You might never see him, but you can't prove he doesn't exist, right?
Yeah, that's a problem we're having with Bigfoot.
Yeah, exactly. So no one will ever believe you because you can't prove something doesn't exist. So one of the problems with an observer-based system is that people get fatigued, they get bored, they're looking for something, a needle in the haystack, they don't find it, they get distracted, maybe their text goes off and they happen to look at their phone while they drive by a floating nutria turd in the water and they miss it, right? So we wanted to develop some other detection techniques that wouldn't be so reliant on a human observer. The human observer is incredibly important. You can't get this work done without people. But you got to come up with techniques that sort of compensate for the weaknesses in different systems of detection. And so one of the things we had worked on that actually evolved from a trapping technique was the guys would use what they called false beds. So they'd make a fake nutria bed along a waterway, set a foothold trap or a conibear on it, and then the nutria would come along and see that, and they're like, oh, hey, there's a nutria bed.
That's a good
trick. Yeah.
Just quick tech question. When you guys would set up a bed set like that, would you guys run a one-way drowner lock down to a stake?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
So we were required to check any trap that held an animal alive every 24 hours. But we had an exemption that allowed us to go as long as 76, I think, or maybe even 96 hours if it was a killing trap.
Yeah.
And so we did rely on the submersion sets to make sure that animals were dead.
Yes. Not. So what we're talking about there is imagine that you got a trap set up at the surface of the water on a little bed, or you could set up, just for illustration's sake, imagine it set on the bank of a river. That trap chain, like the little tether of that trap, has a thing called a one-way slide on it. Mm-hmm. And then you drive a stake into the riverbank right next to the trap and run a wire from that stake to another stake that's driven down into the bottom of the river out in the deep water. And when an animal gets hooked in that trap, especially an aquatic rodent, is instinctively just going to jump in the water and dive down to get away. So he runs that one-way sliding lock down that wire, but it won't come back up.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was a effective and important tool for us. And these false beds became more and more important as a detection tool. So when we were going back through and mopping up these areas, we didn't want to set traps if we didn't have good reason to believe there were nutria there. So we would just make these false beds and check them. But the problem is when the tide would come up, it'd wash them away or the grass would grow up through them. So one of the guys thought, well, hey, what if we put down a piece of plywood to keep the new grass from growing up? And then, well, that solved that problem, but it still washed away on a high tide. So he said, well, what if we put it on a little piece of styrofoam? And then, so we did that, and then we built a little rim around it to keep the wind and water from blowing stuff off the top. And this thing evolved into this detection platform that we would put these things out by the hundreds.
That's a good idea.
And check them for scat. And we wanted to get a sense of how nutria interacted with these devices, so we put some remote trail cameras on them. And we got a couple interesting things. And they were staked with a fiberglass pole, so if the water came up, they would actually float. And they would work all the time, whether the tide was high or down. And we got one video where two nutria got on a single platform, and they were 24 inches square. So one was already up there, and the second one got up, and it was just too much weight. And the whole thing kind of tipped sideways. Water swept over the whole thing. And then the first nutria got off, and the second nutria got on, and all the water and everything just kind of swept out the opening. We had one side that had an opening with a little brace on it that we could set a conibear trap on. Okay. So if we detected something, we could instantly turn it into a removal device. And so that got us thinking of like, man, we could be losing all these opportunities to detect sign if we're relying solely on the presence of scat to do this. So one of the guys went back to the drawing board and came up with a really clever use for snare cable or aircraft cable. And he took about a 3 or 4 inch piece of it and he frayed the ends of it and made a little tool to make it easy to do and built it, sort of bent all the little strands backwards. So it formed this like multi-pronged tiny little grappling hook. And then he built a little support wire, like a snare support wire out of stainless steel welding rod and attached that to the platform and then made this little figure eight loop system on the end of the welding wire.
Catch hair.
To put that snare in, and it would catch hair when the nutria brushed against it. So we actually implemented that, and then we used the cameras to determine, we actually did a little study looking at the detectability of nutria on these devices by the camera, by the presence of scat, and by the presence of this hair snare. And the hair snare was like remarkably effective. It detected like 98% of the visits to the platform, whereas the scat was
you don't know if he had
very
to go
unreliable.
Yeah, you don't know if he had to go or not.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, all of these techniques sort of evolved out of necessity. And, you know, this had never been done before using the tools that we had available to us anywhere in the world. There had been one successful eradication of nutria in England, but it was all done using baited cage traps on rafts. And so, you know, we had to sort of forge our own path on this. And so all of this creativity stemming from our local trappers was critical in sort of evolving our tools as the needs of the program changed as we approached eradication.
So how many years into it, or how many years did it take to get there?
So we began trapping out the Kora Blackwater in 2002. We trapped out the last known infested watershed in 2013, I think. The Wicomico River was the last one we trapped out. And so I left the project in 2014 to take a promotion. And so the folks that have continued on in my absence have continued to look, and they did clean out a few animals in that Wicomico watershed the following year. But it has now been 2.5 years since we've detected a nutria anywhere in this ecosystem that we've trapped. Now, we've had some struggles, you know, funding. One of the criteria for eradication is institutional support has to continue throughout the length of the project. So you've got to have that commitment to provide the resources to get the job done. But bean counters like to look at, you know, results, and the easiest result for them to measure is how many nutria we're catching. When you're not catching nutria, it's a lot easier to start sort of pulling back some of that funding. So we've had some issues there. The staff is about a third of what it was at the peak of our efforts. But we've tried to combat that by also increasing our efficiency. One of the things that I had started before I left the project was this concept of using scat-sniffing dogs to help us find nutria. And more importantly than helping us find nutria, because we had used dogs throughout the program to eliminate nutria as a hunting technique. But when you're trying to prove, they call it proof of freedom in the invasive species, proof that an area is free of an invasive species, is to layer multiple detection technologies and techniques on top of each other to give you enhanced confidence that there's nothing there. You know, you can never prove that they're gone, but by building a strong case of circumstantial evidence, you can reach a conclusion that the nutria have been eradicated.
Like human observation, no one's seeing any. They're not showing up in your fur catchers on your floats.
Exactly.
Dogs aren't finding their droppings.
Exactly. And so the dogs' true value here is not in really finding nutria, although it would be important if they did. Their true value is enhancing our confidence that they are in fact gone, because their sense of smell is remarkable, and a human observer is going off visual cues. And you know, you walk through this marsh, and you know you were in it today hunting for sika deer, and imagine.
Would that have been a good nutria habitat?
Yeah, we removed probably 70 or 80 nutria from that general area.
Really?
Right in front of where you were hunting. That was all prime nutria habitat.
Really?
Yep.
That's the kind of stuff they liked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So imagine having a cover like every inch of that marsh between where you were and that far wood line. And we had to scour that. And when you're down to maybe there's only one or two nutria left in there, what are the odds that two, three, or even four people just walking back and forth are actually going to find that one little piece of scat or whatnot? So the dogs.
Yeah. Well, Steve had a dead deer 150 yards from him, and, you know, without GPS technology, it'd be hard to find that.
It's hard. I had to walk around there a little bit. Even I shot a waypoint from my tree stand to where I thought he was, you know, just like a bearing and then a distance. Walked over there and was like, I don't know. He's got to be in here somewhere. And just, you could miss a lot. So right now, do you think that if you know, within 20-mile radius where we're sitting right now, you don't think there's a single living nutria? Or do you think there's got to be one that you missed?
You know,
it wouldn't be one, right? It'd be, if there's one, there's no worry. Two. One boy and one girl.
Exactly. And so what we know about their ability to reproduce and their detectability when they reach some sort of critical mass, we would reasonably expect to be able to find them if over the course of 2 years that, you know, we've been looking, that if they had sort of rebuilt a small population, we probably would have detected it. I'm pretty confident of that.
If you did find a small population, you'd have to get in there and just like be
right, hell's fury. Rapid response. Yep. Get it out as quickly as possible. So I have a lot of confidence in the crew that we put together and the folks that have remained on the project are really committed and talented. And I think that the fact that they're not finding anything is an indication that there's nothing to find.
So how are those people that are still working on it, how are they coping with the job anymore?
Well, so, you know, about five of them now are detector dog handlers. And honestly, part of my rationale for getting that tool off the ground is a bit of a morale booster. People love to work with dogs. And so even if on a daily basis they're not getting their own personal satisfaction by finding a nutria, they're getting some satisfaction of working with a dog and training the dog and making sure the dog is still up on top of things. But even then, it's a challenge. You know, the guys that have been with the project from the very beginning talk fondly of the good old days, you know, and they miss it.
You got to be careful. One of them might just keep that job to retirement.
I wish I could tell the story we heard the other day, not about nutria, but I wish
that's
I could tell.
My follow-up question already. I have it is...
Cause I got one more main question.
No.
Then can you mind?
No, just not at all.
Wait for one more main one. So other places that deal with nutria, okay, they still deal with them in Louisiana too. Like, are other places that are dealing with infestations, are they looking to what you guys did? Are you exporting the technologies, or is it just like so regionally specific?
No, actually, that's a great question. And one of the criteria that was built into the funding legislation that supported this program from the beginning was that one of our missions was to help to educate everyone else who's dealing with nutria with tools and techniques that can be helpful elsewhere. So we put a lot of effort into outreach and working with other folks that are dealing with nutria. We still get a lot of calls from people dealing with nutria. There's been a new outbreak or invasion in California where they had previously, there'd been a small population that had been eliminated, so they didn't think they had a problem, but I think stuff is now moving down from the northern states there. And just this past summer, I was invited to visit Holland, where they have a problem with nutria invading from Germany, coming across the border and infiltrating their canal system, which is critical to life as they know it in Holland. So, you know, we've shared this technology, these techniques with other folks throughout the world. But I started to talk earlier, and I'm not sure I ever finished the thought on the sort of the biological criteria you have to be able to meet in order for
eradication
to be feasible. And one of those is you have to be able to put every animal at risk. And that's why getting the private landowners on board was so important. All these thoughts running through my head. I've forgotten all the things that I used to be able to rattle off in all my slide presentations. But
yeah, it's been 2 years, man.
Yeah, it's been a little while. So you have to have techniques that are effective. So we, you know, work on all these different techniques, techniques that are socially acceptable. So, you know, there are toxicants that could be applied to eliminate nutria, but they're probably also going to eliminate a whole lot of other species. So that's an important feature. But when you start looking at those criteria and applying them to other areas, we were very fortunate in Maryland, the Delmarva Peninsula, which is that land spit between the Chesapeake Bay and the Atlantic Ocean that's comprised of the state of Delaware and the eastern shore, the Chesapeake portions of Maryland and Virginia, is essentially an island. And the nutria that we had here were introduced. They didn't expand from somewhere else. It wasn't an expanding population. And they're limited in their northern distribution by winter weather. So essentially we had an island, a big island, but it, you know, it was an island that we could sort of get around and eliminate. So if you look at places like Louisiana, which have an almost identical ecological problem to what we have here, they have the same sort of coastal marshes, the same suite of plant species that are impacted, and the same effects of nutria, but it's orders of magnitudes greater than both in size and in numbers of nutria than we have here. They don't have as severe winters, so they've got more reproduction taking place. And they estimate that in Louisiana, in the first 10 years after nutria were introduced, as few as probably 20 animals had attained populations of 20 million.
20 million?
Yeah, and they're everywhere, and they're in adjacent states, so there's no way to get around the problem, you know. So that one of the other criteria is the risk of reinvasion needs to be near zero. So on the Delmarva Peninsula, we had that very low risk of reinvasion unless someone chooses to bring one in. Louisiana, unfortunately, surrounded by a sea of nutria, so they'll just have a constant influx. So they took a much different approach. And rather than hiring trappers to, you know, trap down to a near zero population level, they looked at the history of nutria trapping activities in relation to the fur market. And they established a bounty system based on historical pelt prices to encourage and incentivize trappers to pursue nutria in the hopes that they could depress the population enough that they wouldn't see the amount of damage that they did. So they monitored that by conducting annual vegetation surveys, and they take a helicopter and fly these. They had like 1,500 miles of transects or something like that. And every time they reached a nutria, it's called an eat out when they sort of destroy an area of marsh, they'd fly a circle around it, and they'd do that every year and measure the size of those circles. And if they were contracting, then they were sort of moving in the right direction. If they were getting bigger, they weren't taking enough nutria. So to put it in context with Maryland, over the life of the project, and you remember earlier I said, you know, as many as 50,000 nutria on Blackwater Refuge alone, we've removed about 14,000 nutria over the lifespan of this project. Far fewer than we anticipated at the beginning. And if you compare that to Louisiana, their incentive program, their goal is to remove about 400,000 nutria a year. And that seems to be enough, the target that keeps that marsh damage at a somewhat acceptable level.
Gotcha.
So other places that have expressed an interest, we've had visits from folks in South Korea, China, Israel. We were invited to participate in a big workshop in the Pacific Northwest probably 10 years ago now. But then it even crosses species. We were actually asked to come and consult on a beaver infestation problem in Tierra del Fuego in extreme South America, where they were introduced, ironically, about the same time that nutria were introduced here.
We did a large aquatic rodent swap.
Yep.
You ever see a capybara?
Yep.
Yeah, I saw some capybara last winter, man.
Nutria are actually pretty closely related to capybara. Right, okay. Yep. But the Argentinian military brought North American beaver in to establish fur for military clothing. So they released them, and they thought they'd have trappers go out. And, well, as it turns out, they didn't have a trapping community. People didn't know what to do with them, and they expanded and proliferated, and now they're...
They should have tried to introduce trappers, too. Yeah.
Well, that's...
Cut a male and a female trapper loose out there.
Our agency's been approached about conducting some training activities down there to help... kind of educate folks on how to effectively trap beaver and whatnot. But part of that is, you know, the goal is eradication, and trapping for fur and trapping for eradication are two different things.
For reasons we explored here tonight.
Yeah.
It's a good story, man.
Yeah. It, It was a pretty exciting chapter in my career.
Yeah, but the story starts to make its own gravy, you know? It's like just got like a lot to it, man.
Yeah.
Yanni, what was your conclusion?
Conservation through eradication. When Steve first told me that, I was like, man, that's a ringer. Now you pretty much answered it, but I was going to ask like where the closest next population is to the south. And then, you know, if it could come this way, but it sounds like you have that, the barrier of the Chesapeake Bay, that they're not going to swim.
They are in relatively close proximity in Virginia Beach, is probably the closest place that we know about.
Virginia Beach has some?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole stretch, that southeastern Virginia and northeastern North Carolina, that whole complex down in the Albemarle Sound and Alligator River National Wildlife Refuge, Matamuskete National Wildlife Refuge, and then right up into the intensively urbanized areas in Virginia Beach, all the drainage systems and whatnot. There's nutria on the Naval Air Force bases down there.
God, it's got to be good for alligators, man.
Well, in Louisiana, it is. A lot of the nutria trappers sell the carcasses to alligator farmers. So they get $5 for the tail that they turn in, and then they get $1 or $2 for the carcass that they provide. So, but, you know, the Chesapeake Bay, the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay is about 14 miles wide. That would be a pretty significant dispersal effort to get a nutria to swim across that.
Yep.
So the narrowest point of the bay outside of the mouth of, or the head of the bay where the Susquehanna River feeds into it, is actually right here in Dorchester County. It's about 4.5 miles across to Calvert County. And in the 1990s, they found a small population in a tributary of the Potomac River. And the Maryland Department of Natural Resources trapped about 50 animals out there. And they've never seen a resurgence of that population, although occasionally we get reports.
You guys need to move on the Norway rat. Eliminate rats. Yeah. You know, an interesting tidbit is my brother was telling me that Anchorage is the world's largest port city with no rats.
Interesting.
And when they get a boat that comes in, if they inspect it, if they find rats on it, that boat does not touch shore.
Yep. Yeah. Well, you've been to New Zealand. Their biosecurity procedures are pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Fly in. They put out literature about making sure your hiking boots don't have weed seeds and your camping equipment.
Oh yeah, didn't you get messed with for having muddy boots coming into New Zealand?
Yeah, I don't know if we got. I can't remember now if we got. It was a long time ago. If we got messed with or if it was just protocol, but they basically took all of my fishing gear, not the flies and reels and poles themselves, but the clothing type gear and all of our camping gear. And they took it into a room. And I think you could actually watch it. And they basically fumigated it.
Yeah.
And then they put it in a plastic bag and said, here you go, have fun.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they take their invasive species stuff pretty seriously. And they're
that they don't have 1,000 invasive species
right.
already.
Well, that's why. They're working aggressively to try to eliminate them as much as possible. So
right. Yeah, we saw traps all over the place for what they call stoat, which is a
little weasel.
Weasel. Yeah.
Steve, you got any final things that fall so far out of context that you didn't get a chance to bring them up?
Oh man, so much. I was initially wondering if I could possibly talk about this for 2 hours and
we door-nailed it, man.
But, I think the one thing I'd like to just reiterate as a concluding thought is a plea for people to, you know, recognize the importance of traditionally urban or rural values and activities and the contributions they make to modern day conservation. You know, this project would have been extremely difficult without the local knowledge we were able to tap into through the trapping community. And, as I mentioned earlier, that crosses species and, you know, it's a segment of our society that's much maligned and there are routinely efforts to eliminate trapping and the kinds of traditional wildlife management tools that we've used. And, you know, they still have an incredibly important place in a modern society. And I guess that's something. Even, I think, non-trapping sports people often don't think about trapping that much and don't have the support.
Yeah, all you bird doggers.
Yeah, ill-advised group of folks that tried to. This is my concluding thought that the last year during the last election cycle had tried to get through an initiative in Montana to ban trapping on public land. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought of, you know, I had in my pocket like a dozen reasons why I thought that was a bad idea. One of the things that my pocket did not include was the one the director of the state wildlife agency came out and said, why would we be putting ourselves into a situation to pay government people to do something that you have other people paying us to go do? Mm-hmm. Speaking of beaver removal, he's like, we do not have the budget to take care of all of the conflicts, agricultural, road, other, all of just the beaver conflicts alone.
Yep.
You got a whole squad of people out there who, you know, are running like little small businesses trapping beavers, and you want to take that away from them, those beavers are going to cause problems, and then we're going to have government guys doing it. Mm-hmm. You know, that measure was soundly defeated.
Yeah. I actually have a second concluding thought want to just make sure I emphasize the importance of sort of partnerships in tackling monumental conservation issues like this. And without the joint efforts of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources, Tudor Farms, and the hundreds of private landowners that supported, as well as a ton of several dozen non-governmental organizations like the Maryland Trappers Association and the Salisbury Zoo and other groups that sort of rally around the environment that really helped to generate the support to keep the funding in place and all that sort of thing. Those partnerships are just critical for the success of programs like this.
All right. So be a good partner.
That's right.
That's my final concluder. All right. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.